Hello and welcome to the third night of Millennial 2018. I'm sorry about the delay, but there were some technical problems. Now, before I begin, I do have some rather, not sad news exactly, but a wee bit worrying. The fact is that Survive the Jive needs your help. He has lost his only source of income aside from his channel, which means that he's probably going to have to go full-time with the channel in the near future. And for that reason, naturally, he could do with some help, maybe on Subscribestar, where he has set up a page. I think that's probably going to be the case for a lot of us. But anyway, in his case, he needs your help. So if you enjoy his videos and you want to keep him help keep him going, then please consider helping him, supporting him in that way. One-off donations are great, but so are, you know, routine monthly donations that the creator can rely on. I know this myself very much. So, okay, with that out of the way, I think you all know Survive the Jive, so I don't need to tell you about his channel or whatever. So, okay, with that out of the way, I'll now welcome Libertas Metapolitics. That is a new YouTube channel. And hello, welcome to Millennial, Libertas.
Hello. Hello to everyone watching. Thanks for having me on.
Right. So before we begin, why don't you introduce yourself? Tell people about yourself, and your channel, and then we'll get into deeper stuff.
Yeah. So Libertas Metapolitics. I'm a fairly recent addition to YouTube. Just started this summer. So if you've not heard of the channel, obviously go check it out. Generally, I make videos about all the kind of political themes that bother me at the moment. So self-esteem in the West and the lack thereof, why the left backs immigration, despite it harming the native population the most, the native working class the most. So that sort of thing. Sometimes the videos are topical to current affairs, like Brexit, and sometimes they're a bit more abstract. Most recent video has been about the Brexit fiasco and how it's just indicative of the complete lack of popular representation in British politics that we've got at the moment. So I think that's a pretty comprehensive summary, I hope.
So tell me, why do the left support, or do you want to get into your history first before we talk about stuff like that? How did you get into this area of politics? How would you describe yourself? An identitarian, alt-right, alt-light? What would you say?
Yeah, so I mean, I've been involved in politics for a long time in terms of being interested in it. I used to be in the Conservative Party, actually. Who I've now abandoned for UKIP. But in terms of ideology, the only thing I'd kind of pin myself down to is just being a pragmatist and empiricist. So I kind of go with what's working. And there's a quote by John Maynard Keynes that goes, "When the facts change, I change my mind." And that's always something that's kind of stuck with me. And I think in recent years, the facts have changed so much in the West that we're now seeing some of the kind of long-term effects of the policies that Western liberal governments have put in and the negative effects that they're having, and more broadly of the kind of crumbling of the prevailing narrative, the liberal narrative that's been dominant for so long. So I think in response to that, I've shifted to the right. I used to be sort of, you know, classical liberal libertarian. I've shifted more to the right in response to that, and especially in favor of kind of tradition and the fruits of tradition, which I think is what a lot of people have, people have done in the West as well. The kind of populist wave is mostly an expression of people's shift towards tradition.
Tell me what you mean by what is that to you? I mean, obviously I know what the word means and everyone knows what the word means, but I want in your terms, what does that mean?
Traditional societies, I think, built around things like family, marriage, all the kind of traditional social structures. So, you know, all the various aspects of the leftist attack on society tend to be focused on areas of tradition. So it could be the feminist attack on the family and the LGBT attack on heterosexuality and birth rates, or it could be the attack on patriarchy and competence hierarchies and that sort of thing. The attack on the idea of there being hierarchies, that everybody should be equal and everybody, no matter what you do, should have the same outcomes. I think all those kind of structures arise from traditional societies, and there's been an attack on them or an attempt to overcome them. And that's what postmodernism is, really. It's an attempt to kind of overcome all these traditional structures. But I think a lot of them are rooted in kind of what it is to be human, and you can't really. I think that's also a big part of the backlash at the moment is a return to human nature, perhaps.
I think that there are quite a few interesting ideas come up from what you just said. One of them is it is interesting to me that the drive towards equality, egalitarianism, seems to go hand in hand with a drive towards oblivion. Nihilism and low birth rates and all this, it seems to be the same thing. It's weird how the same people, and you see the opposite as well, that like the same people who want hierarchy and differentiation between things are also much more positive about going forwards into the future, whereas the people who are much more about equality seem to be quite down in the dumps about the idea of extending life into the future. There seems to be a real nihilism and almost miserableism about equality.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And I think right-wing ideology and a belief in hierarchy and the struggle of life and the meaning that's contained in that is something that's kind of an antidote to the left-wing liberal paradigm. Like you say, nihilism, the reason that equality is nihilism is because the idea of hierarchy, it's almost to do with, you know, human nature and the Promethean spirit, the spark of the divine inside all of us, and the will to rise out of the dust and rise forward and reach the pinnacle, reach the top of the hierarchy, that's inside all of us. And I think leftist equality of outcome thinking is so anti-human nature. And to say that if someone does go through with that struggle and they discipline themselves and their complete drive of will and force of will brings them to some great outcome, to then go to them and say, no, you don't deserve that because it's all based on this, that and the other and privilege. And really, you're actually a bad person for achieving this great outcome. You're actually, you know, it's flipping it on its head. You've reached the top of the mountain. Yeah. But that actually makes you a scumbag now. And
you've poisoned everything. It poisons everything, doesn't it? It's like, I remember when that guy, the space thing, what was it called? Matt something. He coordinated the landing of a satellite probe thing onto a moving meteor in space. It was absolutely amazing. It was like a unique achievement, never been done before. And that was like the best day of his life. He'd worked for decades to get to this day, this achievement. Yeah. And what happened? He was wearing a shirt that was misogynistic, so feminists pilloried him and ruined the best day of his life. And I always find that absolutely amazing. And not without needing to get into the whole feminism thing. It shows this utter hatred of, achievement. Like, you want to bring someone down at the time when they are triumphant. I thought that's just disgusting, really reprehensible. But yeah, I think this thing about equality and struggle, because it came up with Mark Collett last night, that struggle is a sort of essential, sacrifice is an essential thing, because without that, you just become despondent and depressed and listless. And I think, it does seem that a lot of people who believe in equality are ultimately, they're not suicidal, but they seem to think nothing of their people dying out, their nation dying out, their civilization dying out, because, you know, to care would be too much effort. It would involve sacrifice on their part.
Yeah, and it's like you say, the guy who was wearing the misogynistic t-shirt and they ruin him. I think a big part of that is the left wing psychologically seems rooted in envy and resentment, and moreover, a lack of self-esteem and a lack of belief in oneself. It's like, I can never reach the top, so let's just bring the top down. It's like, you know, that's not really that's not an inspiring politics to me, to say that I can never reach the top, so let's bring it a bit closer to me. I think everyone should strive for the top. And I think that's, you know, being the best you can be is a noble part of being human.
Absolutely.
And you mentioned, kind of discipline and struggle and all these types of things. I'm a big fan of Jordan Peterson, and that's why I like him for a lot of the stuff that he talks about in terms of responsibility. And it's a message that the fact that he's got such a big audience, I think, is indicative of the fact that so many people in the West are looking for that message now, when everybody's talking about rights and what everybody deserves and how, you know, nothing's fair and everything needs, you know, all these injustices. There's never a focus on what can you actually do, what responsibilities should you take, and what change can you make.
Yeah, and it's depressing when, if you're not thinking in those terms of what can you do, then you become a slave. You become sort of just a lump who's waiting for someone else or society to do something for you. But you have no agency anymore. I mean, that's really depressing.
Yeah.
It must be very demoralizing.
Definitely. And it doesn't surprise me that depression is such a big problem in Western societies now, when that's the kind of narrative that's pushed on people. And we often talk about kind of, in the right-wing dissident movement about the left's attack on, well, we started talking about tradition and the left's attack on tradition. And I think there's something bad about that, because part of the struggle should also be a selfless struggle, in that we have a duty of custodianship to the people who go after us and the people who went before us. And the left has this terrible habit of judging all of history at its lowest point. So, you know, all the great achievements of the past, it's always judged by the lowest point, and it's always judged with one eye on the present, so that some leftist student who's read, you know, the Communist Manifesto and been to some sort of diversity classes and now thinks they're really enlightened can go and judge the great people of the 1800s as if they're so superior because they have this knowledge that they have now.
I mean that's a ridiculous thing about the modern left, that they will say, well, Western civilization did this and this and this, but so what? These evil white men didn't believe in trans rights.
Exactly. You know, like they weren't even a thing back then.
Yeah, it's absurd. But I mean, I've heard that said. You know, that, well, it wasn't so good if you were a one-legged gay lesbian vegan. I mean, come on, for fuck's sake. It's absolutely absurd. So what was the question that came up? And you said something about the intro, why the left, and I was going to ask you the question, but now I've forgotten what it was.
Why the left backs immigration despite it harming the native working class the most.
Yes, exactly. Go into that.
Yeah, so I've got a video on that, and it was basically, it's done in a kind of Mortal Kombat theme as an attack on Jeremy Corbyn and the left, but it's just to highlight the fact that the leftist movement at the moment has been completely co-opted by these middle-class lovies from London, whereas it was supposed to be the kind of working man, and they love coming out in their flat caps and pretending that they're the Sultan sweat of the earth, but really they live in their gated communities, they're all on great pensions and have plenty of income, and they all live in these very undiverse areas by and large. And then if you look where the migration goes to, it goes to these working class communities, and it crowds out social housing, it crowds out the use of public provisions, and it has all these other negative effects which the left don't have to deal with. And I think it's mainly because, as a voting bloc, migrants tend to vote for the left, so they're actually more useful as a political tool than the working class that they were meant to be representing.
Yes, indeed. I mean, it's this hypocrisy that, and it really sickens me that they can't have the self-reflection to think, well, hold on, do I live in this, the areas that are going to be affected by this? Is it right for me to be blasé about this? They don't seem to care. It's something that the champagne socialist, I mean, I've said before, the champagne socialist is probably the archetype that I despise the most. In all of this, you know, all of the modern Western culture, because they are so lazy and indulgent in their thinking. They don't seem to be serious. They don't seem to be intellectually serious or morally serious at all. They're very frivolous and indulgent. And of course, the effects of that are devastating. I mean, you know, every girl who got raped in any, whatever town you want to name, by Pakistani child groomers, that is, I lay the blame for that squarely at the feet of champagne socialists, whether writing for The Guardian, reading The Guardian, or working in the local council, the Labour Party, the media, wherever. I see them all, and of course they reinforce each other's indulgence and stupidity and shallowness of thought. They're really awful. I don't know if there's any use for them, really. I'm trying to think, what are they good at? But I guess that there must be some, they must be optimized for some function in society, but I can't think what it is.
Well, getting political power, it seems. That's all they're optimized for. I mean, it shows as well, what you're saying shows by the fact that those in the establishment left who speak out against such things as grooming gangs like Sarah Champion immediately get ostracized. So they nail their flags, they nail their colours to the mast quite happily. But for anyone watching in the chat, if you check out that video, The Left versus Immigration, there's a link in the description to a map that I use in there, which gives a breakdown of the nation in by white British versus various other different ethnicities and backgrounds and so forth. And you can go street by street and look at the percentages, and it's all working class areas that are in the sort of 3-4% white British. And it's all well and good to say, oh, you know, diversity is great, I really love being able to go to my fancy restaurants and get this great cuisine, oh, the cuisine is to die for. It's all well and good saying that, but if you actually have to live in a street where you're 4%, only 4% of the people are your native population, and you may be a working class person who has lived there for generations, and now it's completely unrecognizable. Like, I've got footage of places like Southall and Wembley in the video, and these places don't really look like English towns, and it's completely changed the character of it. It's not just the people, it's completely changed the cultural character. Like, people bring their cultures with them. So it's all now, you know, the shop signs are written in different languages and things like this. And I just think that would be very sad for someone, you know, empathetically speaking, if you'd lived there your whole life and your parents and grandparents and great grandparents, and then suddenly you don't recognize this, and it's happened so quickly in 10 years or so. And then the people that are supposed to be representing you in parliament, your left wing Labour Party, are the ones who did it. And then they go and virtue signal about how you're some kind of bigot. And it's like, wow, that is a real betrayal.
Well, yeah, they demonized you for being a bigot. You know, the betrayal is just amazing, really. But again, then there's the lack of self-reflection that enables them to do that as well. You know, it goes on and on. I find it really sickening, because we are talking about real people. I think the left has this, especially the champagne socialists, I think they have a notion of people that it's almost like they're just items on a game board. They're not actually real. It's like the immigrants, the Muslims are not really real. They're just our brown pets, as I've said before, and they'll do whatever what we want, and we'll be nice to them, and we'll treat them with respect. But they don't actually treat them with respect. They treat them as assets, accessories, fashion accessories. And I don't think they actually understand that these are 3D people who will have their own agency and have their own desires and goals and so on. So they will do stuff and they will disobey you. They'll do all sorts of things that you would not want or approve of, and eventually they'll usurp you as well. And likewise, the working class are real people, and you might find them uncouth, unappealing, whatever. Doesn't really matter. They are real people who deserve respect and who have their own agency and their own goals. And again, they'll eventually do stuff that you don't want them to do. But and if they don't do that, then they're still real people. You know, the working class are still real. And I think that the champagne socialist, again, has this utterly contemptuous attitude towards people in general. Because do they really respect people of color, Muslims, blacks, or do they see them as just something to make themselves feel better? I really cannot stand the champagne socialist. That archetype, I think, is an awful thing in society. I mean, it's not actually modern. You know, they've existed for a very long time. Dickens, right, has characters who are essentially champion socialists. That's like 150 years ago now, 140 years ago.
Yeah, and Orwell complained about it as well, and a number of different writers throughout history have complained about this kind of archetype, like you talk about. And as you say, they're real people, and they're the real people that you were meant to be representing. It seems so deceitful to kind of come out with this whole working class, we're the proletariat pretense, and then just sell your own people down the river. I think the left, especially in a lot of countries in the West, they're junkies who are kind of hooked on the immigrant vote. And that's why I said at the beginning, like, it's important to be a pragmatist and an empiricist, and to kind of reflect on what's actually happened. I mean, fair enough. If you're pro-immigration back in the kind of 1950s and you think, look, this is all going to work out, it's going to be great. But now that we're here in 2018 and you can look and see at some of the effects that have had been, you know, some of the effects that have been had in communities around the United Kingdom, and some of the problems that have been caused as a result of mass migration, it seems clear that it's time to have a review of this and be, you know, that's why the tradition is rising up, because people are nostalgic for this old kind of time when you could leave your doors open. I mean, good luck with that in London at the moment.
Well, I mean, when you see footage of old, as we say, old England, old Britain, I mean, just like 50 years ago, it's not that old, it's not that long ago. The transformation has been extremely rapid. And when you see footage from that time, from the 50s, 60s, even from the 70s and 80s, to be honest, you cannot help but think, my God, I like modern technology, but basically everything else is probably better back then.
Yeah, and it's not the kind of... it's just the homogeneity of society and everybody kind of understanding the rules and playing by the rules. And I think that's one of the other things that shifted me from classical liberal to more kind of right-wing, traditionalist, conservative. I'm definitely on the nationalist side of the kind of nationalist, globalist paradigm. And the reason for the shift is that classical liberalism and all these kind of structures that we value are essentially a game. It's a game that we all play in society, but it's a game that requires us to cooperate with each other. The rules of classical liberalism must be self-enforced. You know, the liberty principle by Mill. It only works if you enforce it yourself. You can't have the police going around enforcing everything. And I think that's why our society is becoming increasingly authoritarian, because people aren't cooperating, because we've lost homogeneity in our society. We've lost the sense of nationalism and national ideal, and everybody playing cricket, as it were. And as a result of that, you have to have the state step in and enforce things and, you know, solve community tensions and all these kind of things that would never exist in the first place had they not created the community tensions by these, reckless social changes, social engineering.
Yeah, indeed. Somebody has just said that Dave Cullen showed footage like that today of Dublin, and the video got put into limited state. I don't know about this.
Well, but, the classic. Yeah, sorry, go on. I was going to say the classic example is Asia Bibi. So Asia Bibi is this refugee from Pakistan who, she's under threat for her life over there, and she tried to claim asylum in the United Kingdom, and they said, no, you can't come in. Essentially because the Pakistani Muslim community in the United Kingdom will kick off. And there's been many cases of this where people have, you know, there's lots of different sects of Islam, for example, and people are the wrong sect, or they're apostates, and the penalty for apostasy in Islam is death.
Yeah.
And so as a result, there's this major inflammation of the community. And it's like, well, we shouldn't have, is that not a fifth column?
Well, this is the problem when you bring in lots of different people from all over the world, and it's all diverse. You get their diverse arguments and rivalries as well. Their vendettas, you know, the arguments that they had, God knows where, are now transplanted to our streets and cities. I mean, you get Turks and Kurds and so on warring on the streets of Germany. It's amazing, really. But it's not actually that amazing. It's just completely predictable, because of course they're going to import their vendettas from way back when, or way back then, Of course they are. Why would they not? Why would they stop caring about this stuff?
Yeah, exactly. And it affects our ability to make decisions in the national interest, because I imagine if you polled the majority of your average Briton, they wouldn't have a problem with Asia Bibi. Sure, she's under threat. She's a single asylum seeker. She's done, you know, nothing that's grievously wrong as far as we can tell. Give her asylum. You know, we've got a long history of giving people asylum when they're under serious threat and they're, you know, a political threat. But because of the massive Pakistani Muslim community in the United Kingdom and the grievances there, our hand is forced.
Well, to be honest, it's a similar rationale for the banning of Brittany Pettibone, Lauren Southern and Martin Selner from Britain. Because the idea was that they would I think this was a pretext, but whatever. The rationale was that they would inflame community tensions or tensions between communities in Britain. Well, you know, if those multiple communities weren't here in Europe, in our countries, then it wouldn't be possible to inflame tensions between them. So it's kind of absurd. But they are here, and therefore we have to change. White people have to change our behaviours, and we have to ban each other from our countries in order to placate these migrants, these migrant communities, as they now are, as they have been for decades. But you know, in the 80s or 70s or whatever, these migrant communities would just have had to deal with it. You know, but now they have this; they're here in such numbers that they now have this ability to, alter our behaviour. But then again, I'm assuming that I think it was largely just a pretext, but whatever. I can understand the government's thinking, I know actually these people should be kept out because they will, you know, the Muslims will kick off if these people are here. But the point is that shouldn't be possible. That situation is perverse. It's absurd.
As you say, it
needs to be cruel to someone like, I've forgotten her name, Asia Bibi.
Asia Bibi,
right. Yeah. So what were you going to say?
I was going to say, yeah, it might be a smart decision, ultimately, in terms of we don't want all this aggro, but it is also a reality check. Like, okay, look at the situation we're in now. We now have to take into consideration the kind of the offences that someone internationally might have caused to the Muslim community in the United Kingdom, which may be quite at odds with what the majority of the British people think.
The majority of the British people, the native Brits, would not care about Asia Bibi being here, Brittany Pettibone, Lauren Southern or Selner being here. That is of no importance to white British people. They would not object at all. The people who would object are, well, hardcore lefty activists and Muslims.
Yeah, and interestingly, I was going to say, you mentioned about the response to it, as in trying to make all the communities kind of play nice and introducing hate speech laws and this kind of stuff, and it's all aimed at lowering tensions or, you know, it's all aimed in treating the symptoms but without focusing on the underlying disease, and that's probably a bad word to use, but the disease is the lack of homogeneity. As in, the problem is there's no focus on integration. There's no focus on overcoming this thing long term or any kind of.
I think the integration thing is long gone. I think they've given up on that completely, to be honest.
Well, because of the numbers, because of the scale, it's such migration has been so huge compared to what it has traditionally and historically been. That obviously when a lot of people move into an area at the same time, they're faced with the same kind of challenges and the same experience. And so they, you know, group together. It's like if you're all going into university in the same year, you all go in and you're like, oh, you're in the same year as me. You're in the same house as me. Da, da, da. Of course, immigrants all group together. And it's not the actual immigrants' faults as individual. It's our government.
It's human nature. Training.
Yeah. And why wouldn't you want to come to Britain, you know, as a British patriot, I think is a great country, so I can understand why people would want to come here, but I'm not okay with it if it's going to change the nature of the country and make it not so great in my eyes. because obviously I'm prefer British culture to Pakistani culture, and if I wanted to go experience that, I would go over there.
Yeah, of course. No, I think that the integration thing has largely, you never really hear about that now. I think they've just assumed at this stage that we've got multiculturalism and, you know, we just have to work with that. But even that is now being sort of given up on. I really think that we are heading towards an acceptance that that this is an impossible situation. And I don't know what the result of that will be, but I think that, for example, basically what I'm saying is, I don't want to go any further than to just say this, because this is what I am sure of. I think that the diversity thing is heading towards its end. I think it's increasingly difficult for people, you know, the champagne socialists, the politicians, to keep just chanting this mantra. I don't think the public buy it anymore. And so something's going to have to change. I don't know what it will be. Maybe it won't be policy, but I think that it's not working anymore. And also, I think that it's also increasingly obvious that if the government cannot control things with the numbers of non-Europeans who are here now, then it is utterly insane for them to be allowing more non-Europeans into Britain and Germany and France and so on. You cannot exaggerate how crazy that is. Clearly, I mean, Morgoth just put out a video today about the situation in France, and he made this point that if they have to, and I made this point back in 2015 after the Charlie Hebdo thing. I made this point that if they're monitoring tens of thousands in France, they're monitoring tens of thousands of potential jihadis. Well, how the hell are they going to afford to do that 10 years from now or 20 years from now when the numbers are like 10 times that? How can they possibly afford to employ the spies and, you know, all the staff, the computer hackers, everything, the police, security guys, everything, to protect and monitor the activities of these people when there are such huge numbers of these people? It's simply impossible. But then you've got the problems that come with diversity itself, leaving aside the jihadi stuff, the simple problems of diversity that we've been talking about. All of these problems are exacerbated by larger numbers, the ever-increasing numbers. So basically, we can't deal with it as it is now, but we're still diligently making it worse and worse and worse and worse every single day. Sort of piling up this impossible task for ourselves. Now, how does that make any sense at all? Of course it doesn't. It's simply nuts. And I think that the realization of that must be inevitable. I don't think it can be stopped, really. I mean, among the public and eventually even amongst the myopic champion socialists, what would you say about all of this?
Well, I think the government has got their head firmly planted in the sand, I think, for quite a while now. I mean, I'd say the least they can do would be to stop the inflow or bring it to much more manageable levels. Theresa May herself has said that she wants to bring down net migration to the tens of thousands, but she was the longest serving Home Secretary in 50 years and has now been the Prime Minister for 3 years and has completely failed to achieve it. So she's got all the power to do it. She just lacks any real will to do it. She's just, talking about it to try and get votes. She doesn't mean it at all. So, obviously they need to stop the flow, to stop adding to the problem. And then, you know, maybe integration could work. I think integration would be a lot more likely to work if the numbers were far less and there was more of an effort made to actually integrate people. It's an uphill battle because naturally communities will stick together, but I don't think there's ever even been an effort made to integrate people. Multiculturalism was the kind of mantra back when this all started under the Blair years.
Multiculturalism actually goes back to about the mid-70s. As far as I can detect, I think that was when it first started being pushed in the teacher training colleges in London. I believe it was like 75 was when that decision was made. And then nationally, in about 81, 82, after the Brixton riots. And that was when multiculturalism started as a sort of government policy. And then in the 90s, that sort of became formalized and normalized with the Blair government and so on. So sorry to interject there.
Yeah, no, that's it. But it was pervasive all the way through this huge boom from 97 on when the numbers really went up. And if you have that kind of ideological rooting during such a time of mass migration, you're going to see communities segregate off because they go, oh, well, it's just multicultural, you know. But even then, it's not. I mean, if it was multicultural, but all under one, I mean, that, yeah, it's not going to work if you have the multicultural ideology at the same time as you have mass immigration from similar nations. Like, there's so much immigration from certain nations. They basically form their own national colonies inside the UK. So that's why I think nationalism is a good response to this, because at least if you have a strong, homogenous national identity that says, okay, here are the rules, then people are more likely to integrate into that rule set. Whereas if you have a weak identity and a weak rule set, then there's nothing for people to integrate into.
Exactly. I think that's something that was not really appreciated, and I think still isn't really appreciated, is that power... See, I don't think we understand the nature of power. And there's a lot that... There's a huge amount that could be said about this. I nearly gave a speech on it in October, but I realised I just couldn't do it. But I think that this needs to be talked about. And what I was going to say here is, I think we don't really understand that power comes from things being concentrated together. And so, in this case, people. Like, 1,000 Pakistanis, let's say. In fact, let's not say Pakistan. Let's just use a sort of harmless example. Chinese people. 1,000 Chinese people spread across Britain. Like, there's one of them in each town or something. That's no threat to the culture at all. 1,000 Chinese concentrated in one area becomes a power center. And then the greater that number becomes, like 2,000, 5,000, 10,000, the more power there is. And so, and it becomes something that acts in opposition to its surroundings. And or not in opposition, let's say in isolation from its surroundings, discrete from its surroundings. It can interact with it as a separate entity. So you've got the Chinese block, basically.
Quite right.
This is something I don't think was really understood. So, and now, but now we start to see, oh, this is part of the agency that I was talking about earlier. They have their own agency. They form power blocks. They're not just going to succumb to our principles. They're going to live together, live alongside each other, reinforce each other, give each other solidarity, and they're going to do things that we didn't tell them to do and that we wouldn't want them to do and that we don't understand and that we don't have a fallback plan for and that we don't know how to react to. They're going to do all of this stuff that's baffling to us that confounds our plans. But yeah, that is what they're going to do because they're you know, human beings.
Yeah, well, the whole thing comes down to kind of groups and group identity, I suppose. The liberty of an individual within a larger group only exists insofar as there's no other opposing group. And it seems like mass migration and a lot of other things like postmodernism and multiculturalism and all these different ideologies have created lots of subgroups within the nation that now compete with each other in a way that I feel is far more extensive than it would have been in the past. And that creates a lot of problems. And like we were talking about earlier, it then creates all these issues where the government has to step in and then start policing community tensions and things like that,
it's a nightmare. It's a complete quagmire.
Yeah. And it's all off the basis of human nature. I might say as well, I think it's kind of a feminist response as well, or a more feminine response to different groups not collaborating together, is like to say, you know, play nicely, let's everybody just get on, can we not have too much fuss? Whereas if it was a more kind of masculine response to this situation, it would be like, right, look, these are the rules, this is the national identity, these are the national rules, everybody integrates into this, we're not going to have the massive Russian community move into the United Kingdom and then live by Russian laws, and we're not going to have the massive Chinese community move in, and we're not going to have the massive, you know, Azerbaijani community or whatever. It's like, this is not a workable system for a nation that makes decisions at the national level. If you're going to make decisions if you're going to have that multiculturalism, then you need to be making decisions at the level of that monoculture, those individual, you know, cohesive units that are existing within the nation. But then what you're talking about there is the breakup of the nation slowly. Because
yeah, and nobody wants that. Nobody voted for that. So why the hell are we now even talking about that as a possibility? How off the track have we become that we're even discussing this? But it is a possibility. I mean, it's a very real possibility. Some would say it's what happened in Albany.
It is what happens as well, because I mean that's why you have sort of community policing and Sharia courts now and things like that. Because these communities have become so strong, and their own legal systems and their own way of dealing with disputes and all the problems that a community might face are so different to the national way of dealing with things, that they have to set up their own sub-legal systems and so forth, and ways of adjudicating these disputes. And it's only going to continue getting worse unless we re-establish a national identity and re-establish what the actual rules are and allow people to integrate into that. And it's kind of one of those things that, you know, maybe there's kind of community tension that happens beforehand, but then eventually it's like, okay, well, everybody integrates. I don't know. It's such a difficult problem now. But I think
it's just far too late now.
Yeah, potentially, but the politicians are burying their heads in the sand, as they have done for a long time, and moreover are continuing to make it worse. They really have no solutions for us.
No, none. But somebody has said, what if they want the chaos in order to justify a police state? Right, to bringing in a police state. That this has been said to me by other people as well. They're creating chaos in order to this assumes that the powers that be, which might not be the politicians, whoever, civil service or whatever, they know what's going to happen, and they're deliberately engineering this so as to, because they know what it will result in, and they know that the public will crave order and authority. So it will, in other words, they will accept a police state. What do you think about that?
Well, I think sometimes you can definitely infer motives from the outcome. So if it creates instability and it has been done anyway, and you can't seem to understand why has this been done, then potentially it was done to affect that outcome. People are calling for more authoritarian policing. People are calling for, you know, people actually buy into the hate speech thing, never asking the question of who gets to decide what that is and what the rules are and, you know, who's going to judge it and all these kind of practical problems that are very, very important as to not impinge on people's liberty and freedom of expression and all these things that we valued so much for so long in the West. That are coming apart, and for what? Like, what's the trade-off? Is we get multiculturalism, great, okay, thanks. And you lose free speech for that. Well, it's not a great trade in my eyes. Is it to bring in a police state? I don't know. I mean, a lot of the politicians at the moment do seem authoritarianly minded, and people like Theresa May have always tried to bring in more kind of Snoopers Charter type stuff. They love
having... I remember what Amber Rudd was all about. She was fucking nuts. Sorry, I shouldn't be so crass. But she wanted, was it 15 years? 50. I mean, see, I know that that would probably never have come into law, but it goes to show what the character of these politicians, that she would even say that as a something that she would look into, that she would look into implementing this. 15 years in jail for looking at I don't know, far-right content on the internet. 15 years. This is schoolmarm, a sort of nurse ratchet mentality to a level that we've never seen in politics before in the West, I don't think. It's just amazing. Imagine being so contemptuous of liberty and, you know, personal liberty and stuff, that you would punish somebody that severely just for looking. But the fact is that she mentioned that as something that she would want to do. That's Amber Rudd I'm talking about, who was the Home Secretary after Theresa May became Prime Minister. Amber Rudd got her job as Home Secretary. Is there anything good that can be said about this? But sorry, you go.
As a quick sort of laugh for everybody, or she kind of got her comeuppance, and it's a lesson in never apologizing or never buying into the kind of punching right narrative and hoping the Guardian won't say nasty things about you, because obviously in the end she had to resign over the Windrush thing after being all authoritarian against you know the evil free speech people on the internet.
Yeah, there was this sort of screw up with the Windrush thing. I can't even remember what that was now. But it's funny that it happened on the 70th anniversary year of the Windrush. But yeah, that's another matter. Let's not get into that. I think that, as you say, there is an authoritarian streak in Theresa May, for sure, and this awful woman, Amber Rudd. I mean, you'll have probably seen that clip of her getting a guy shut down, a speaker at a, I don't know what it was. It was some debate or discussion in a church, I think. And she just she sort of scribbles something on a piece of paper, hands it to the debate host, and then he shuts down the speaker. Really amazing to see.
I've not seen that.
Oh, yeah. I'll send it to you later. Yeah, that's Amber Rudd. The point is that there is an authoritarian streak in these people, and I think that they do have contempt for the public, to be honest. I think that's a fairly easy conclusion to draw. And what happened earlier this year, that sort of period of darkness where they, you know, Tommy Robinson going to jail, Count Dankula being convicted, the three people being banned from the country. Yeah, that was scary. That was a scary time, and it seems to have petered out now, but, you know, it shows the types of people that we have in government and in the civil service and in border security as well, of course. This is what they're prepared to do to people.
Yeah, well, the state is always trying to grab more power for itself, although I think there's been a real power grab by it recently, especially with new technology coming around. They're desperately scrambling to try and control the internet and control as much technology and use technology as much in pursuit of surveillance and in pursuit of all these different things as they possibly can, which is something that worries me quite a bit. And you know, I think there's a number of different power hubs in that as well. It's not just the government, it's the government in collusion with technocrats and large Silicon Valley firms and all this sort of stuff, and the media, and it's all become far too much of a cozy relationship. But the guy who mentioned in the chat originally about the police state and whether it's the politicians within the country who want that, it could also be external nations and external powers sowing discordance in the nation to weaken it and destabilize it. And equally...
You mean Russia? Russian interference?
Yeah, the Russian bots. who knows? It could be anyone. But just because we were going on the line of, you know, what has happened can potentially infer motives. It could be, you know, people wanting to destroy the West, whether that's a nation or sort of academics or leftists and things like this, who like, going back to the beginning of what we said, people are fundamentally resentful of all this kind of stuff, and they just have this real guilt complex and kind of resentment against the world. It's like they want to destroy everything, and the West is at the moment on top, so it's, you know, the biggest best thing to destroy. And then the other thing I was going to say about the police state is that it's kind of, if the politicians are doing this and are stoking this in their own nations as an excuse to bring in more authoritarian policies, it's worked so far, but in the long run it's definitely a false economy. And I think things like the Gilets Jaunes uprising recently has shown that the police are only being paid so much, and they're not going to want to face down a revolutionary mob of angry people who are paying too much taxes and, you know, all this sort of stuff. I mean, some of the stuff we've seen in France recently just shows that, you know, no level of police state will ultimately work in suppressing people who really, really believe strongly in something, such as the Western nation and freedom.
Yeah. It's interesting that the Yellow Jackets thing does seem to be nationalistic, in the sense that, and I don't mean that they're identitarians or ethno-nationalists, I simply mean that they it does seem to be about France as a nation. There was one protester who said something like, for our society, for France, for our nation, or something. And then that became a slogan. That's quite interesting. Because it does seem like the nation is a recurring object of reassurance for people, that their nation, like not any particular nation. That's quite a sort of bland, banal thing to say, but I think in this day and age it bears saying, because I think we're taught so often that our nation doesn't matter, and yet it does seem to just keep being the source of identity and reassurance for people, regardless of the fashions of the time.
The nation is almost mythological in the fact that in the way that people value it, because not only has it got all this shared identity, shared history, shared culture, and so forth, it gives people meaning beyond religion. It gives people meaning. And the reason that people fight for their nations and have done historically for a long time, and the reason that the nation and nationalism never seems to be crushed despite globalism and the European Union and the left's attempts repeatedly to crush it, is that it provides you security in the belief of a future for your children. And, if you have a certain way of living and you live in a strong nation and you can pass that onto your children, you're more secure that they'll live good, happy lives. It's like, if you go back to a sort of primitive state of affairs, if you live under a strong chieftain in a strong tribe, and you have children in that tribe, you're more secure in the knowledge that they will go on to thrive and have good lives and they'll have enough food and all this sort of stuff. So I think it's quite a primitive thing, people's love for the nation and the group. And nations seem to be fairly naturally occurring to me, in that they normally come up to the bounds of some sort of quite historically rooted cultural, geographic allegiances that might change slightly, but over very much a long-term time frame, and the attempts to change them so rapidly in the past few decades with the kind of globalist projects and supranationalism from the European Union and now the whole no borders crowd, it doesn't surprise me at all that it's evoked a massive backlash, because people do value these national structures. They do have meaning, and they have great meaning. I mean, we were talking earlier about the working class. If you've got no money, imagine everybody is just, imagine there are no nations for a second and everybody's just living in the world in their different areas. If you've got no money and you're quite poor in Britain, well, the best thing you can give to your offspring is a British passport. I mean, if they've got nothing else, at least, they say to have been born an Englishman is to have already won the greatest lottery there out there. I can't remember the exact quote, I'm paraphrasing, but
to be born English is to have won the lottery of life.
That's the one, yeah. So to be able to give your offspring a British passport and feel like your life and your efforts and all the kind of will and determination and discipline that goes into achieving the most you can achieve in life is going into not only improving yourself, but improving your children's lives, but also improving the entire group and your community, which will then have further beneficial repercussions to the future. I think that's something that gives people a lot of meaning, and it's the stability that comes out of nationhood that people really value. And nations are stable structures and have been stable structures. And
they're also reassuring, comforting stories. It's not just stability and sort of practical. I think it's also very, as you said, mythological and spiritual. That certainly is what it is for me with Britain. I don't need to go into it. You say what you think about that.
Yeah, you're quite right. It's aesthetically pleasing, and it's aesthetically pleasing. It's nostalgic. It's everything you grew up with. You hear the stories of the heroes of your nation, and you're very fond of it. And I don't think that's something that we should just dismiss. I don't think it's something you can dismiss. And I was going to say our critics say that it creates war, but even if that was true, which I'm not sure it is, I think you'd still be a fool to trade the occasional war in foreign fields for a daily war on your doorstep. If you create complete disunity in your nation,
and you have a really good way to put it.
Yeah, well, if you create all this kind of disunity in the nation, crime rates go up, and you have community tensions. Well, you've traded, you know, the occasional war where in a foreign field where you have to lay the law down and defend your national interest for this ongoing war, this ongoing lack of safety and security in your nation, crime rates through the roof and a lack of stability. And it's a bad trade. People should not make it.
Yeah, it certainly is. Let's go through. There were two super chats, which I want to get better at integrating into the conversations. My apologies. I'm not good at it yet. I'll admit that. Anyway, so what we were saying about the authorities creating chaos so as to justify a police state. Someone else put this super chat in. What if the elite will close the borders before it gets to total collapse? And thus destroy the working class, but keep a high IQ elite, thus destroying competition. I'm not really sure what you mean. What if the elite will close the borders before it gets to a collapse, destroy the working class, and keep a high IQ elite, destroy the competition? I'm not sure how closing the borders would destroy the working class. I'm not sure what you're saying there, Todd. But as for the general thing about destroying their own competition by... I suppose what you're saying is, it's probably not, there's probably not much time for you to elaborate, but I think what you're saying is that they would mix the native white working class with third world migrants who are less cognitively endowed, and thus make the white working class a sort of less of a force in society, less... agency, and thus the elite would not have to worry about them overthrowing them or something like that. That could well be a plan. That wouldn't surprise me at all. Now, right at the start of this hangout, British Brainwashing Corporation posted the following super chat: Libertas Metapolitics, astroturfing in Chemnitz really shows what these so-called representatives are up to, and they spend our money, and what they spend our money on. Treason is second nature to them. And he was referring to the Chemnitz authority, the authorities in Chemnitz, local authorities, putting on this unbelievable concert in favour of diversity. It was like a music concert in favour of diversity to uphold that, you know, multiculturalism and all this. After the attack on that guy and when the protests were going on, they gave the people bread and circuses in order. And actually, they I don't know if you know this, but they bussed people in from all over Germany to be the audience at this concert so as to make up the numbers. You know, it's really very perverted.
Morally perverted. Shout out to British Brainwashing Corporation. He's a fan of mine. I think he's referring to, I've got a video called Astroturfing in Chemnitz, in which I go into all this sort of stuff. It's ridiculous. It's actually CWE, I think they're called the mayor's office in Chemnitz collab, because obviously there was these big protests led by the AfD and Pegida, and they kind of march through the streets and all this stuff, and there's loads of media attention. And then 2 days later, they have this huge 60,000, 70,000 rock concert with a big lineup of bands in the town centre. And it gets you wondering. I mean, for anybody who's kind of baffled by this, go watch the video because it goes through it in detail. But how did they get that logistically, operationally, how did they get that concert there? Well, the answer is that they collaborated with the mayor's office to get the permissions to hold the concert there. The mayor's office then also denied permissions to the AfD and Pegida marches that wanted to go there at the same time. They spent funding on it, putting on closing roads. They closed roads. They put on coaches and buses into the city. They also had sponsoring by Eurocar and loads of different bus groups and things like this to bus people from outside the city, because Chemnitz is only a population of around 200,000. So to have an 80,000 pop concert of like 20, 25 year olds is impossible unless they were literally, you know, people from the whole surrounding area. Even the president of Germany, the president of Germany went and gave an endorsement of it on Twitter and Facebook and was like, yeah, I suggest you go to this thing. And it's like, wow, okay. And then you look at the turnout for this thing and what happened. And there was the guy on stage chanting alerta, alerta, anti-fascista. And the whole crowd is chanting anti-fascista, anti-fascista. all against these AFD normal moderate right-wing guys who are protesting about the stabbing of a German citizen by two New Deutsch on their streets. And they're protesting against this. It was a silent protest, national flags only. There was no far right stuff. And then they, you know, all the anti-fascists are paid and bussed in with the help of the SDP mayor to go and put on this rock concert. And it's just crazy. And all to create this narrative in collaboration with the media. It's astounding.
Bread and circuses, isn't it? Yeah, it's so, again, it brings us back to the champagne socialist shallowness. Imagine being able to just brush aside these concerns, these existential concerns about identity, culture, society, religion, nationhood, and so on, just by putting on some shitty rock concert.
Yeah. Well, I think it's deeper than that even, because it's indicative of a very scared establishment. Because the only reason you would put that on is to try and desperately control the narrative. So you'll notice, for example, with the Brexit march or with any kind of march that happens against anything left wing, really, it's always reported in terms of the counter protest. So say that the Brexit march goes on the 9th, Brexit means exit march. And the way it's reported is anti-fascist protesters turn up to counter Brexit march. So now Brexit is branded as fascist. And that's, if you Google it, that's what all the top results come up as, from The Guardian, from The Independent, and all those other mainstream rags. They're desperately trying to control the narrative. And so when something like Chemnitz happens, and it seems like it might be a kind of flashpoint in this whole thing, in a kind of European spring type situation where they're suddenly like, oh, we're losing control here. They're so desperate that they're, okay, what can we do? Let's put on a massive rock concert and get loads of bands and get loads of people in there. And then we can film it all and then say, oh, Germans stand in solidarity, gegen Hass, against hate, and and all this kind of...
Yeah.
But it's completely fabricated.
It's just a wonder that they didn't get Bono in there. Billy fucking yeah. Bragg. But what I really mean is, obviously, you can see why the authorities are doing it tactically. You can understand it. What I'm more disgusted by, well, equally disgusted by, is the shallowness of the people who attended the concert. Did they not think, hold on a minute, my countrymen are being murdered and my countrywomen are being raped and so on. It really doesn't matter how much I enjoy rock music. Something very serious is going on, and I shouldn't attend this concert because it's helping the authorities to do nothing about the rape and murder of my people. But no, the enjoyment of rock music is more important. I just find that so telling about the champagne socialist, the sort of middle class. You know, I remember when I did that huge video about the migrant crisis. You might not remember this, but you know, in 2015, I did a huge 2-hour video about the migrant crisis. It was the biggest, longest video I'd ever made at that point. And the point in it that I was most pleased with was that the middle class seemed to have this detachment. What I'm talking about now, they have a sort of, it's like there's a part of their brain missing. And I say this, you know, I regard myself as middle class, culturally at least, and in terms of my background and so on. But, it's so easy to have contempt for them because they... There does seem to be something missing, that with the working class, there is an understanding of community, basically, and from that nationhood and so on. But with the middle class, it's like they're just into consumption. And this Chemnitz concert is a perfect example of that.
Yeah, I think it's all to do with the indoctrination that happens through academia and through education. It's a friend of mine actually did a dissertation on the statistics where, you know, they always say that people who voted Remain are more educated. If you're more educated, you're more likely to vote Remain. His research looked into the fact that actually it wasn't that it was more educated people that correlated with voting Remain. It was that voting Remain correlated with holding progressive views, and holding progressive views subsequently correlated with being educated, because it's basically an indoctrination factory for progressive and sort of leftist views.
Being educated, having gone to university no longer correlates with being educated in any meaningful sense of the word. You know, it was really indoctrination.
Quite right.
So, you know, it's not quite the compliment that they want it to be and that they pretend it is. You know, well, I'm educated. If that means that you spent 3 years being brainwashed into cultural Marxism, I'm sorry, but that you're not educated in the sense that we meant that word 100 years ago. An educated man, an educated gentleman, an educated lady. That's not what you are with your fucking, degree in post-colonial studies.
You're a fucking 3 years of getting off your face and circle jerking about diversity and, having a couple of skim reads of the Communist Manifesto.
Exactly. Okay, I suppose we should wrap it up now. I can't remember if there were any other... Oh, yes. I wanted to ask you about Jordan Peterson because you mentioned him earlier on. And I'm not going to jump down your throat about this at all. Don't worry. I'm very open-minded about this. Obviously, a number of people will know that I have my disagreements with Jordan Peterson and whatever. Believe it or not, you can probably guess what I'm about to say. I did actually spend quite a few, like about 18 hours cleaning this room before Millennial started, and I have rearranged it and done all sorts of things, so I'm not against his advice. We can go into it much more deeply than that. I'm being kind of humorous here, but his stuff, I'm not against him wholly. I just think that what he says is about, I don't know, 10% of what needs to be said, and it sort of hampers the other 90%. You know, the way he articulates things, his individualism, I don't even care about that. I think that it is right that people have individual agency and responsibility and they should conceive of themselves as individuals. Yes, 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 of course. But what I can't stand is this thing about this, when he refers to identity politics as a pathology. No, it's simply human nature asserting itself. From underneath this, a very artificial fabric of individualist consumerism that has been created over the last 70 years in the West. Identity always mattered to people, and now it is simply reasserting itself. And so to call that a pathology, I think, is just so disingenuous and stupid. It's infuriating for me to hear that, and to hear that he does seem to succeed in... trapping quite a lot of young men in this thinking. I don't know how many, he says that he's rescued lots of, like, thousands and thousands of young men from the alt-right and from identitarianism. Well, good luck, well done, because you've just sabotaged your own country. Like, Canada is fucked. It demographically, it's doomed. So well done, Jordan. That's what I would say to him if I had him here. Well, actually, what I would say to him if I had him here is I would simply ask him, why should white people be okay with going extinct? That's what I would ask him. But I'm not going to put you on the spot there, because I know that you're not Jordan Peterson and you probably don't support him 100%. But tell me, I've gone off on a rant here. I didn't mean to do that. I meant to open it. I've already sullied it. I didn't mean to do that. You tell me, and I will be open-minded, what do you think people can get from Jordan Peterson? And don't be nervous. I'm not going to jump down your throat.
Yeah, no worries. I really appreciate Jordan Peterson because obviously of his attack on postmodernism and a lot of the kind of... Well, I think, for example, he touches... Left-wing thinking generally comes as a package. And it's kind of like being unplugged from the Matrix for a lot of people. They swallow all these different narratives and all these different stories that they've just heard in the media. For example, feminism is great, da 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 da. Identity politics is great, da 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 da. And if you've gone through the brainwashing factory of the academy, then you come out with all these views. And I think Jordan Peterson does a great job in unplugging some of those people in certain ways. Also, like, I don't agree with everything that he says. But his deconstructions of the biblical lectures, I think, are incredible. And his lectures on the deconstruction of the Bible, I think they're incredible. And they talk a lot about... See, I actually think that a lot of the stuff that Jordan Peterson says goes back to the beginning of what we were saying, in that he talks a lot about meaning and struggle. And I think those elements of Jordan Peterson's teaching necessarily fit well with a right-wing ideology far more than they do with left-wing ideology. So it kind of pulls people to the right-wing side of thinking. It unplugs them from toxic leftist ideology. And the only part, the only bit of the puzzle that, the only bit of the puzzle that, that Jordan Peterson misses is, like you said, that identity politics, in some sense, is human nature. And he always refers to Western civilization and Western this and Western that, but he's not really, he never really gives a definition of it. What does he mean by that, other than kind of Christianity and things? He's not, he doesn't really go dig down deep into that. And I can understand why he wouldn't want to, because it, it might be a difficult thing to answer. Also, I mean, for me, Jordan, one of the things Jordan Peterson said, I think it was on a Joe Rogan podcast, was one of the things that actually made me realize that things were going to ultimately turn towards a nationalist way of thinking. He said the left are bringing together this unstable coalition where, because politics is all about power and power balance, and the left are bringing together this unstable coalition against the right, made up of Islam, made up of feminism, LGBT, and, you know, they've added in trans and all these different groups, and now you've got like the pro-trans feminists and the anti-trans feminists and all these different postmodernist groups, where society is made up of all these groups. They've got this grand coalition, but ultimately a lot of them all hate each other. So Islam and feminism can never really coexist as a stable coalition. But because
of course not.
There's a kind of Newtonian element in it, in that every action has an equal and opposite reaction. And in creating this grand coalition of Islam and feminism and all these different postmodernist groups that they've blobbed together to get as much power as possible and create this bloc, in doing so, they're creating a backlash and creating a reaction, which is actually stable, because they're creating a nationalist response to that to balance it. But when their leftist coalition collapses, the nationalist coalition will still be standing. And that for me was something that was kind of eye-opening. It's like the center ground is very quickly disappearing because the left are creating this power block. There needs to be some balance to it, and the balance will be nationalist and anti-globalist, because the kind of two things go together. Nationalism is a lot more about kind of borders and structure and order, whereas postmodernism and globalism is more about no borders and chaos and all this sort of thing. And I like the kind of metaphorical terms he speaks in, because sometimes they seem to be the only appropriate way of thinking about these things in an abstract sense. So those are the kind of ways that I appreciate him. And I can understand why he doesn't go too much into identity politics, because he doesn't want to be caught out in a kind of gotcha, you know. It's like, if he's like railing against identity politics, but then and then he's like, oh well, and gets into kind of other kind of identity politics, or talks about anything, you know, it's always that they want to take baby steps and stay whiter than white, especially because he's got such an absolute pack of people out after him. But I think by and large he speaks his mind, and I think he does do a lot of good. And I'd be surprised if that's true, what he said about bringing loads of people over from the alt-right. I think people are more likely to go in one direction than the other.
Right. Okay. All right. That's an interesting defense of Jordan Peterson. I mean, I don't want to attack him and have it in from. I just wish that he would stop railing against identitarianism. Okay, let's leave it at that, because I think we've been going for longer than I intend. I think that's about an hour and 10 minutes perhaps by now. And I'm trying to keep these concise, and I'm not doing well at that. Okay, one last question for you. And this, you can answer this as briefly as you like. Do you think Theresa May is going to survive this vote of no confidence tonight?
I think she will, but I hope she doesn't. There was a really good video on Twitter by the old defense secretary under the Thatcher government, who said, quite rightly, I think, that she's created this constitutional crisis. We're at a complete roadblock where she's delayed the vote. The only way this can turn around is with a new leader. And if she manages to hold on to power, which she's been incredibly good at doing because no one likes her and somehow she's still in office, then... well, what's she going to do? The EU have said they're not going to renegotiate. She's got a deal that she knows she's going to lose. what's her out? What's she going to do? Just go hide in number 10 for another couple of weeks until she's dragged out or something.
Yeah, that's an amusing image. I hope she does do that, actually. It'd be very rewarding for us all. Okay, let's leave it at that. So this was Libertas Metapolitics. It's a very interesting discussion. I enjoyed it. Okay, so thank you, Libertas, for appearing on Millennial.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you for having me. Great discussion.
Yeah, and thank you to everyone for watching. I'll be back in about half an hour with 100 Handers, so that should be interesting. All right, Libertas, good luck with your channel, and maybe I'll see you again next year. And in the meantime, thank you to everyone for watching. See you soon.